Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study Sangha discussion on the three marks of existence and Dhamma talk that introduces the 8th week study of dependent origination. This was recorded on February 4th, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So last week's study was on the three marks of existence, so I'd like to hear how your study went. And any insight into how developing an understanding of impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and resulting dukkha relates to developing an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That's the test. And if you don't notice it, that's okay too. I'll talk more about it. But start with Jen. Good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. I can appreciate how these three words all relate to each other and their meanings. I really like the word anicca because it sounds like what it is to me. It sounds like anicca. So it's like this relaxed and then this coalescing and then kind of relaxed, sort of something coming into existence and then going out of existence. It's easy to understand what that word means, just in the very, even in the very beginning. When I was reading the chapter, even though I kind of felt like I was still just letting the words kind of wash over me, because I wasn't quite, I feel like if I try too hard to understand, I don't understand anything, so I just kind of let it, like, let the words come in. And what, one thing that I was noticing was that there was a lot of fear kind of coming up for, and it was just interesting. It was just more of the impermanence. My ego realizing that this was all happening somehow. I don't even know, but. A little distracted. So, I see how impermanence, I see how my ego is constantly chasing permanence. Mm-hmm. Always looking to make things permanent. Yeah. And I see how that causes me to, I mean, that's worry to me. That's how it happens. It's always worry. It's worrying about how I'm going to be affected by future events that are in my mind. Yeah. And that is, that's interesting too and helpful, because worrying has plagued me for my whole life. So really, when, you know, it's been much easier to let go of in that regard. I think what I've been playing with this week is the middle way between renouncing my ego versus just like allowing it but not engaging it. And somehow that has been, I think that sometimes when I notice myself getting upset or frustrated, it is easy for me to just kind of blow it off and say, that's just my ego. And that's really just more aversion. Mm-hmm. And I've had to practice more kind of being with that feeling of frustration and or anger or happiness or whatever it is, just being with that and not judging it. I don't feel like I'm making any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's a way of being gentle with yourself you go through this. You recognize, you first have to recognize what needs to be changed. And if you judge yourself harshly because you've recognized that, you're kind of defeating the whole purpose. So that's, you're practicing
it. This chapter has always, I remember the last time I read it, it caused a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It'll stir up.
It does. Because it's getting to the heart of the matter. The that idea of worrying, you know, fear is finding fault with the future. And of course that has to be rooted in an ego personality that's concerned that there's something going to happen in the future that's going to affect it that you won't be in control over. And as we develop the Dhamma, we realize that the concentration that we develop in meditation allows us to develop that refined mindfulness. So in each situation that occurs, we're able to respond from an understanding of the true nature of reality rather than react. But we have to develop the Dhamma to get to that place. In other words, what it means is that there's no more worry left because we really trust ourselves to respond in a mindful, well-concentrated way rather than being overly concerned that there's something that can actually affect this ego personality. And of course, there is nothing. Like the Buddha said, it's foam on the ocean. But we first have to be willing to go through the process, which is what you're describing. You know, that's the Eightfold Path. There's some worry. I mean, I don't know that I've ever had a student that was really developing the Dhamma and didn't have to face that question of, but what happens to me?
Right.
I mean, it really is the basic. When I let go of all these views, what's left? Because it feels like annihilation.
Right.
And it comes at us in different ways, and I have people express it in different ways, but it really comes down to that.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're letting go of is nothing.
Right.
You know, it's not like it's a little something. It's nothing. A fixed view is itself an illusion. You know, it's just like a magician's trick. They do something. They pull a rabbit out of the hat, and it seems like it's real, and there it is in front of you. But it's not. And the magician knows it. We're playing this game on ourselves. We're playing this game of hide and seek, hide the ego. We're the magician, but we really don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the true magic is to recognize, you know, stop playing games with yourself.
I think that has been, that, and that was something that I was trying to explain, is I've been experiencing a lot of frustration. But it's because I am no longer able to BS myself.
That's right.
But it's,
that can be pretty uncomfortable too.
Yeah, it'll be like, I want to go, you know, I am tired and I don't want to go, just a little example, I'm tired and I want to go to the gym. In the past, it would be, you don't have to go to the gym, you've worked really hard today, you deserve to go home and, you know, just go straight home and, you know, be home. But now, I'm like, well, it's noon, and you don't have to go to the gym till 4. You're tired right now. You might not be tired later. Impermanence.
Yeah.
You don't know how you're gonna feel. You certainly don't. This is definitely your mind telling you this. It's not about what your body needs.
Yeah.
And all of that makes so much sense that I reluctantly drive to the gym. I'm like dragging this like teenage version of myself with me the whole time.
Yeah, fighting with yourself.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Becky, how are you this morning?
Fine, thank you. Nice to be here. Well, I've always been pretty slow, as I do things very slowly. And so I just want to say that I'm one chapter behind.
Well, what's the rush?
But this week I felt like I knew, when Jen said Anicca, believe me, I've never heard that word before. That seems like what's been happening to me this week. And there have been times when the niche part has gotten really bad. And I was so thankful that I've at least come this far in this class, because I was able to have somewhere to go with it. I just had a couple of really good meditations this week. Really, really, really helpful, almost like inspirational. And I would just feel that release, that things would just, and then once I did that, I really enjoyed the quality of my mind for about maybe 10 hours. And then it would come back, it would start again, something would happen. And I wouldn't be able to use my practice or my breathing or my realizing that things are impermanent to get that calmness back. I would have to be like this for like a few hours until I could go somewhere and meditate again, you know, and just but it was so, I was so thankful to have that. And when I do meditate, there is something that happens to my mind that is really makes me I can think the same thing can happen where I'm in that mindful state, and my reaction, I don't react. I just respond, and it's fine. I mean, it's just like, wow, you know, you really understand how to deal with that now. It's not making that feeling come. It just doesn't come. It's just like, oh, well, so that happened. You know, it's just really helpful this week, especially. And I did read chapter the sixth week. I thought I was supposed to read the sixth week. I was supposed to read the seventh. And I felt like I really understood every word I was reading. It was such a good concentrated reading that was just coming through to me. So thank you.
Thank you. You've gained a great understanding of week seven, even if you didn't read it. You know, that you describe an understanding of impermanence that is very profound. You know, that's the, and the way you described how meditation affects you, the act of meditation, using this proper meditation technique within the right framework, interrupts conditioned thinking. And so you're entering in that space of allowing impermanence to be. I know I've said this often, and you probably heard me say it. When the Buddha first presented this teaching, the very first time on the planet, to his five buddies, he gave the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, including an explanation of the Eightfold Path, and one of his followers got it. And he says, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha said, Khandana, you got it. You're now on a Khandana, meaning he had fully developed the Dhamma because he understood the impermanent nature of all things, but primarily the impermanent nature of conditioned thinking and the resulting response to that. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And getting back to what Jen was talking about, when we start establishing ourselves in anything, and the self-referential ego personality must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it. It's relentless and it's exhausting. But the simple and direct way out of that is to recognize the impermanence of every one of those thoughts. And a simple way of doing that is when you feel like you're caught up in something, recognize it, that you've done that. And you can just tell yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. It's simply and ultimately just a thought. And it's a self-referential thought that we're creating difficulties in our own mind over something, over a mind or mental state that is in itself impermanent. And the only way we can make it permanent is to continually to recreate the scenario in our minds. And that is really what's exhausting. Or we can simply let go. Thank you for saying
Thank
that.
You.
Lisa, good morning. It's good to see you this morning. How are you?
Nice to see you, too. Fine, thanks.
Good.
There's never been a time where someone hasn't said something that, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, it's me, that's happened to me, and that's how I feel. And now, too, you know, Jen saying things to Becky, and what you said about, so that, I guess, the chapter had a lot in it, and I'm sure I didn't understand a lot of it, but it seemed to sort of distill into the one word of impermanence. And you said something in there. You were kind of a little more conversational in that chapter, I think. It was a little bit more. That was the basic thing the Buddha was trying to get through to people.
Yep.
And then you just said about, you know, conditioned thinking, what we're holding on to and trying to make this, like, permanent thing in our mind out of rock is actually nothing. That's the impermanence is that you know, this, the conditioned thinking, the, you know, clinging and all that is actually holding on to nothing, like holding on to a cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And then people being afraid, well, that's the thing that feels like, you know, a rock, you know, but that's an illusion. But if I get rid of that, then what is there? You said something about being afraid of
annihilation,
letting go of all that, and then what is there? And, you know, people think, you know, when you meditate, a lot of people have this misconception that meditating is supposed to, like, being mindless. You know, you're supposed to not think about anything.
Yep.
Which is impossible.
It is.
But this is also all about realizing that we're holding on to nothing and that the real thing is out there. Hmm. Buddha's teaching me, like, I don't know, you know, like, the real thing, happiness. But you can't just say, I want to do this to be happy. You just can't. You have to do things, and then you become happy. You can't just say,
it's a quality of mind to be developed.
You know? Anyway, sorry, it's all mixed up. But one thing that has happened over the past few weeks is that where I could go days of not, you know, doing the meditation, now I could forget, you know, but I'm remembering. Oh, I haven't done that. You know, it seeped in to my consciousness.
And that's an aspect also of deepening concentration, just simply remembering what is most important. That's also an aspect of refined mindfulness. So. Thank you. What's left when you let go of all self-referential views? A calm and peaceful mind. And that's what we all want. You know, it's what the Buddha set out to discover. Is there a way to put aside all of our own individual contributions to suffering and disappointment and unsatisfactory experiences? And he discovered that. He set out to do that. He wasn't looking for anything magical or mystical or an explanation of the universe. Is there a way to develop lasting peace and happiness? And he discovered it. It's by letting go of all self-referential views. Not easy. But what's left is a calm and peaceful mind. And the best example of that is the Buddha himself. Speaking to annihilation. There's even traditions within the modern Buddhist practices, but it actually goes back way before the Buddha's time, that when you awaken, poof, you're gone. You just, you leave the existence. And I think it comes from that feeling of that we become annihilated when we let go of all these views. But of course, the perfect example of the Buddha. He awakened at the age of 36, and he lived the remaining 45 years of his life with a calm and peaceful mind. What an incredible accomplishment. And even more importantly, he showed us how we can do it. And those teachings are still here today, right in this room. That, to me, that's the most remarkable thing probably in my life, that these teachings are still here. They're useful, and that, not that I have any special type of thinking or mind, but that I have a mind that can actually use this and develop it in a meaningful way. It's just, that's remarkable. Thank you. Jay, good morning. It's good to see you.
Good morning. Good to be seen. Thank you. I read the chapter. I had little luck absorbing the chapter, to be honest with you. I read the words, but I was just reading the words. Go back to what Jen said there, you know, as a professional career-long worrier, I not only worry all the time, but I worry, should I worry about this or should I spend my time worrying about that?
The ego must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea.
On a practical level, day to day, I think I cope with the things that come up in a reasonable way without getting too excited. And, you know, who I am, the old ego or whatever, and maybe the benefit of what teachings I've managed to absorb here or whatever, but day-to-day, I guess I do okay.
Well, and you're describing how we did. First there's an intellectual experience. You read it, and whether you understand it or not, that's really not all that important. You'd love to. You'd love to read it once, and you got it. But we first have to expose ourselves to something different. I'm going to put Lauren on the spot. The first time you read this chapter, or maybe the next six times, did it have a lot of meaning to you?
Not at all,
no. But now it does.
Yeah.
So I'll get to your report in just a second. It does. I mean, and the same is true for me. For years I read about impermanence, mostly in other traditions that didn't address it in the same way, but it was so vague, and there was no way to really apply it to myself, even though it's an obvious thing. We live in a world, everything is impermanent, it's right in front of us. But to see it in a useful way, in the right framework, that's something that feels very abstract at first. But, of course, that abstraction ends when we start having the direct experience of impermanence in our own life. That's why we need a meditation practice that allows for a deep enough concentration to simply see what's occurring in front of us. But you're developing it nicely. You first have to see it.
So I'd like to be honest, and I wish I could say that, you know, yeah, I read it, and I got them all down.
It takes for most people, except Kandana and a few other people that I've read about, it usually takes a little bit of practice. You know, that's why we need the path. You know, so thank you for sharing that. The real impediment for any of us to that stops us from getting it instantly is conditioned thinking. You know, that conditioned thinking creates a mind state where it doesn't make sense. We don't see how it fits in. But as we diminish our conditioned thinking, then it starts opening up and we see things rather clearly. The whole point, so thank you. Scott, good to see you. Scott hasn't been here in a while, but it's good to see him. I know you're not, or I don't think you're following along with us, are you?
I haven't been, but I have read it before.
That's right, yeah.
But the conversation is really striking. It's good.
Yeah, it is.
I've had some challenges in my life recently come up, and I noticed right away my ego wants to kind of crystallize that experience into something solid so I can control it, you know.
Yeah.
And then I have to cling to that idea and try to reinforce it constantly.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a lot easier when I can let go of that, and part of that is the self too, crystallizing the self.
Yeah.
And I don't know, just because there is impermanence, I guess there's also that ability to get out of the loop, get out of the trap.
Yeah. That speaks directly to the third noble truth. Cessation of suffering is possible. That is an expression of impermanence. If there wasn't such, if impermanence wasn't part of our life, in other words, once we created a self-referential view of ourselves, we were stuck in it, none of this would matter. But that you can say that the third noble truth speaks to impermanence, but the four noble truths all speak to impermanence. It speaks to the possibility of things changing. And then that gets to the real heart of the matter of living each moment in that potential, with that understanding that each moment holds a potential to incline my mind towards awakening or to further ignorance. That's really the choice we have in each moment. And with the framework of the Eightfold Path, we're able to recognize that and move in the appropriate direction. I'm glad you're here. Would you do me a favor?
Sure.
Would you turn the heat back on? I got a feeling it's getting a little cool in here. It's in this room, to the left of the window, that room on the right. And if you move the lever right next to the left of the window, and if you move the lever about a half inch or an inch to the right, it'll get toasty in here in just a minute. There it is.
Is it
on? Yep. It takes a while to actually start. Thank you, Scott.
Sure.
Good morning, Eva. How are you? How's your study going?
Very good. Good to be here with everyone. Everyone has said so many of the things that I've been thinking and feeling. And I've read the book, I would say, about, you know, six times. And the chapters, I am seeing that. And I'm getting satisfaction in the fact that it's all kind of like become a circle to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the Eightfold Path, you know, it isn't you just do this one thing and then you follow it with that. It is going in circles, and every moment you don't know where that point will end.
Yep.
And so the book is kind of the same thing happening, in that when I read a chapter, I remember something else that was said in a class or whatever, and now it's starting to like, oh, that's what that might mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's giving me a sense of lasting peace and happiness. And with the book, when I started it, and just always, as you said, that, you know, that's kind of like our goal, I never really looked to it because I didn't understand it. I couldn't understand it. Because what's happiness? You know, happiness means, oh, you know, everything's fine and all so good. And that's not what you're talking about. And now I can appreciate it, because now I know, kind of, I'm glimpsing what that lasting peace and happiness feeling is. And you really can't describe it. And you really can't tell anyone, oh, it's going to be like this, and then you're going to do this. And it's got to be like, you know, you got to sit down, you got to meditate, you got to read, you got to understand, you got to listen. And then it might come, and that's the circle. Then it's gone again.
Yeah.
And, but it's just, I'm just very grateful that in this time of my life that I've got something that now I can, that's it, helping me to make sense of my life before and where I want to go and do that all with a sense of just letting it go. It really, I can't hold on to it. I've just got to kind of ride it, and like, so it's just been great.
Yeah, thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
We are so fortunate to have the Sangha that we have here. I have to tell you, it is rather unique in modern Buddhism. We're not the only Sangha like this, but to be so supportive of each other, and really everything that comes out of everybody's mouth is supportive of each other. You know, we all get so much out of this. It really is remarkable. You're right. The Eightfold Path is a circular path. At any point, it might be right view that's the most important thing for me to be mindful of right now. And in the next moment, it might be right intention, or it might be right effort. You know, right effort comes into play when we're really too tired to meditate, or my day's too busy, but there's right effort reminding me, time to sit, or time to learn a little bit more about what the Eightfold Path was. When I was putting the book together, I had written most of the chapters, except the last chapter, out. But while I was doing the writing of each chapter, I was always considering, how to place the sequence of it. And it changed quite a bit. Maybe it took me a few months to decide on that, and I'd put it in there and I'd read it, because I could have just as easily started with Karma and Rebirth and used that as a foundation to explain everything else. And what I ended up with was Karma and Rebirth was the last chapter, because it really takes the development of the other previous 9 chapters to put that in the proper context. The same thing with the previous chapter, chapter 8, that I'm going to introduce. Dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to. So logic might say, well, you teach that first. But there's no foundation, there's no contextual foundation for understanding that until much later. But as we develop it, and you said what a lot of students say, it wasn't until they read the next chapter that the previous chapter made a whole lot of sense. But that's just the way the Dhamma is. And it's because of the experiential nature of the Dhamma. We have to experience it before we really know what it is. The Buddha consistently said that. Hepasiko, come and see for yourself. Try it out for yourself. Thank you for saying that. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. My first time through the book, I'm just trying to get through it, and so I kind of remember this chapter. But what I know is that this chapter is kind of turning in terms of it getting more difficult, you know, the understanding of the whole thing. This chapter and the next chapter, or the next chapter should be more. So, but I did look back to some of my notes, because what I guess is significant to me was the when you talked about the chair and deconstructing the chair. Components, parts, so using that as a metaphor for self-identity or something like that.
Yep.
So I kind of had a hard time with that, and I was writing about that, trying to think about that, and I guess one of the places I came to was a sense of relief, actually. I guess in most of my life, one of the things I struggled with was feeling special or good enough. And so I realized when I was reading this, I can just let go of that. It's like I don't have to worry about it. It's not about being special or good enough. It's just, you know, the different parts of the whole, I don't have to be neat and special. And I don't know, there's just this huge sense of relief that came over me.
Yeah. Thank you for saying it. That really is profound. That's what Kundana was speaking to, and what you're just using different words to say the same thing. You're recognizing that need to have a special view of yourself is foolish because it's rooted in impermanence. There can't be anything ongoing that's special about me. And when I let go of those views, again, what's left is a calm and peaceful mind. And it's not a... there's not a real analytical process. In other words, you don't go through this period of undoing. You just recognize it and you let it go. There you are. You don't need to be special anymore. And not to pick on you, this is what we all do, but who was making you be special? You. I mean, the world is kind of set up in a way to reaffirm a view that we need to be special too. But, you know, that's just a foolish view. And even that is rooted in impermanence. Everything always changes. So why not take a view of ourselves that allows for that impermanence? Puts aside conditioned thinking. This is what I am in this moment. And let me be mindful of what's occurring, because that's where my life is. My life isn't experienced in views. It's experienced through being mindfully present. Right here, right now. What's going on?
Search for who am I, you know, kind of thing. So
So, you know, I realize that, you know, that's all tied in. So
yeah.
It's not about me.
And that's even that came up a lot of times to the Buddha. Even then, you know, not even then. Of course, everybody has these wants answers to the great questions: Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? What happens? And every time that question was, and it was often that the Buddha had that question put to him. Sometimes, depending who was asking the question, he would just sit quietly to just reinforce that, not to ignore the person, but just to say that question isn't even relevant. But when he would answer the question, he would say that. It's your questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions. See what's occurring right now in your life. Because the only thing that we can become is right now. The only place where we are, and this, you know, this sounds like almost silly, but the only place we can find ourselves is right here, right now. Most important thing. Thank you. Ellie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Isolating myself in a bubble, which my husband said, and trying to be aware of things that are happening in our country that are really upsetting me. So, and I know they were coming, and I know my issue is wanting to be different, and that's causing a lot of stress, but I can't get.
Are you looking to me for those words of wisdom? I'm just as confused and concerned as you are. Thank you, Ellie. I'm glad you came this morning. You certainly are not unique. I would say probably everybody in this room feels the same way. We are living in the most turbulent times in my lifetime, and I remember things like the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember coming home from school, we used to have air raid sirens.
Yeah,
and you were told that when that siren went off, you went into the nearest basement. And I still remember, you know, I must have been 5 or 6 years old, walking home from school, and the siren went off, and I ran to the closest house, pounding on their door. The bombs are coming. The bombs are coming. I need to get in your basement. This is what I grew up. This is, and a lot of people grew up in that. These are more turbulent times. Back then, I didn't have a frame of reference for understanding that. I have a little bit better frame of reference now. It doesn't take away my concern for what's going in the world, but I will say that I've been able to maintain a relatively peaceful mind, and it's because of an application of impermanence. So something happened last, whenever, I don't remember what the election date was, November something. 22nd, is that right? Or 17th, yeah, it doesn't matter. Something happened on that election day that was, for most people, unexpected. And for many, many people, undesired. But it's all part of the first noble truth. So the first noble truth, when the Buddha says dukkha occurs, or there is dukkha, dukkha meaning everything from mild disappointment an unsatisfactory experience, all the way to extreme emotional and physical suffering, is an explanation of what's occurring right now. It doesn't solve the problem, though, does it? It just explains the problem. Then the Buddha says in the Second Noble Truth that it is individual craving that originates suffering, and then clinging to what we're craving for. So in that moment when Mr. Trump became our president, dukkha exploded in many people's minds. And instantly, and across the world, and instantly, an extreme amount of craving developed for the situation to be different. What's wrong there? It can't be different. It's what occurred. And this is, we're not, you, when you say it's right or it's wrong, now you have to remember there's millions of people that feel this is the best thing that could happen. Just as many people thinking this is the worst possible thing that could happen. Who's right? It doesn't matter. Because what's going to occur in the next moment? Has very little to do with what has previously occurred in our minds. What's most important, as best we can, to understand impermanence and understand how important it is to maintain as best as we can a common, peaceful mind. And if we find out that right in this moment my mind is agitated and I'm distressed and I'm full of fear, be at peace with that. Because that's, your question was, how can I move through this? How can I move through something that I simply cannot accept? That's the wrong way of looking at it. Because what you're telling yourself is, I can't approve of this. And you're saying, you're reinforcing that uncertainty that happened when we heard that Mr. Trump became elected. It happened. We don't have to approve of it, but we have to accept it because it's part of impermanence. Now, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I probably will give a class on this entirely because I think I have to. I'm called out on it enough or too many times. When I look at the system that we have put in place in this country, and I compare it to other political systems that have been around since the time of the Buddha, it's the system that speaks most clearly to what the Buddha said too. The democratic process that we have in this country, while sometimes it moves very slowly, is rooted in impermanence. This incredible system that was developed, how many years ago, in the 1700s, was based on an understanding that things are always going to change. How best can we manage that as a political and governmental system? Built into this system is change, it is impermanence. And so, where I take refuge in that is the fact that no matter what, I don't live in a kingdom. I don't live in a dictatorship. I don't live with an emperor. I live with someone who is, right or wrong, democratically elected. And in 4 years, we can put someone else in if he doesn't do the job. If he's as awful as everyone says, as half the people in the world think he's going to be, we can simply vote him out. Now we also have, think about this, this is amazing to me. If he doesn't have very, very quick success, in other words, if his somewhat radical policies don't show a real success quickly, in 2 years there's going to be so many Democrats that are voted in place that they're going to take over the Congress and he won't be able to do anything. On the other hand, if his policies prove to be a reasonable and sensible way to govern, that probably won't happen, and he'll be affirmed in what he's doing. But what's taking place is that people in this country at least the ones that participate in the system are have a way of getting their voices heard. And so then we can hear too long of a speech today. So then we can get into, well, how did this happen in the first place? Because it really is remarkable that how this man got there. I mean, if somebody said to me 6 months ago, you know who the next president's going to be? Yeah. It can't be. It can't possibly. Not that I have anything. I don't have anything personal against Mr. Trump. I really don't. I am concerned about some of the things that he's doing. But I also know that whatever he's doing is not permanent. I also know that maybe we need to be a little bit shooken up. I don't think we need to be this shaken up. But I think there was some... I don't claim that my view of the world, meaning the political world, is that I know everything there is to know. And I can't know. None of us can know. So I can't say that I don't remember how many votes he got, 60 million, but whatever it was, that all those millions of votes that Mr. Trump got, I can't say that every one of those people is wrong or ignorant. I certainly can't say that they're racist or anti... that just doesn't make sense to me. But I also can't say that all the people that wanted Hillary Clinton to be the next president are wrong either. We can't know that. But we have to accept that we live in a system that, right or wrong, is... I think it's the best system that is most aligned with what the Buddha taught. It allows for impermanence. This country is never taken over by one person. There's a danger of that happening, though. And that can happen the beauty of our system is that we have a two-party system. And if one party gets too strong, then we are really in trouble. And that can happen from one side or the other. In other words, if we're just a country of Democrats, we have no more democratic process anymore. And if we're just a country of Republicans, we have no democratic process anymore. And somehow, over the last 200 and whatever years it is, this process that lends itself to uncertainty has also lent itself to a country where, overall, a peaceful and safe environment has evolved. In the last few months, it doesn't feel like that, does it? But that's the impermanence. That's the impermanence that's part of the system. So what can we do? Should we lose our minds? And I mean, really, because that's what it is. There's nothing wrong with protests. You know, the country is founded on protest. But... I don't have time to teach the class, but I guess it's time to do this. I'll go through DO pretty quickly. When I was becoming of age and having a view that started including the outside world, I grew up during the Vietnam War. I grew up during those protests. And by and large, initially those protests were a necessary part of free speech and part of democracy. We needed people in this country to stand up and say there's something wrong here. And I participated in quite a few marches. Even I think I was like 9, 10, 11 years old getting involved in marches, and then a little bit later. You know when I stopped? I was going to cry. I was at a march in New York, and a serviceman walked by, and he got spit on. This is wrong protest. We can't let protest rise to the level of hatred. And that's what's occurring now. That's what scares me. Is we're not protesting. We're expressing hate. And that's not helpful. It's not helpful on any level. And hate rises from fear. I can understand where that comes from. But it also comes from a lack of understanding. It comes from a lack of mindfulness. And if there's one thing that scares me, it really isn't where the right might be taking us. It's where the extreme left and their protest are taking us right now. And that is scary. I've got to tell you, there's a lot of stuff that's scary. It's not just that. So, sorry for the speech. As people developing an understanding of what real peace and happiness is founded in, it really tells us that we need to take to the Dhamma more than ever. Because the most loving thing we can do for ourselves and for everyone on the planet is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. So, excuse the political speech. I didn't mean to do it. I hope you found some benefit. I understand everybody's agitation right now. Nothing is set in stone. And that doesn't mean that things won't get worse before they get better. But they're really, we have a system in place that if they do get worse, we can quickly turn it around. And that really is, this is probably the only country in the world that we could do that. You know, despite who the president might be. He's not a king, he's not a dictator, he does have an awful lot of power. But the power in this country is in each and every one of us. And in 2 years, we can end whatever he's doing if it's not appropriate. You know? And in 4 years, we can get a whole new person in there. You know. Just to go a little bit further on that, just to make, you know, kind of make the point. When I was younger, there was no possible way that we could ever have a black man president. Impossible.
Yeah.
Almost as impossible was a woman becoming president. It just could not happen in my lifetime. But changes occurred so quickly, not quick enough for some people, that we just had a black president. That's amazing to me. I don't want to get into how the neighborhood that I grew up in, but I grew up in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey, nice little town. Back then, the realtors colluded with each other to not let black families move into the town. They actually showed them houses outside of town when they came in. This went on. And there were a lot of towns. Clark, New Jersey was another famous town for doing that.
I had a great story about that regarding my family. I grew up in Maplewood. And Maplewood was pretty much the blacks were on one side,
yep,
of Maplewood. The whites were on the other side of Maplewood. It was just the way it was. My father was a builder. He bought a lot on the white side of Maplewood, built a house. He was going to originally sell the house. When the neighbors all found out it was a black builder and got all upset, he decided, I'm moving my family to the house.
Yes.
And that's where I grew up.
Wow.
And the town would not even issue him a CO on the house because they did not want to issue a certificate of occupancy to a black family living on the white side of town.
Yeah. That was common.
Yeah. That was in the 50s, yeah.
So, things have changed.
Oh, yeah.
Not enough, but things have changed. We're going in the right direction.
We're going in the right direction.
And, you know, I really think that there were some things developed over the past 8 years that I don't think that in general, that the country was ready to accept completely.
Mm-hmm.
And so this pendulum swinging back a little bit. In my lifetime, we came very close to having a woman president, and we will at some point. I mean, I know it, but again, if you asked me that when I was 20 years old, 40 years ago, I would have said, there's no way. So we're going in the right direction. Impermanence has had a tremendous effect on the overall quality of life for everybody in this country, and I would say for the world. But there are such powerful expressions of extreme views right now from both sides. We need some time for everything to settle down. And it might take some time to do that. But we also have the Dhamma. We have a way of, in this incredibly turbulent world that we live in, to at least calm our own minds down. And if we can do that, Jen just said, can I say, Jen just said that her new husband, yeah, is being affected in a positive way by the Eightfold Path. Excuse me for saying. We can do the same thing. And in fact, if we're going to have any real effect on what's going on in this country, on the world, the only way I can see it is through the Dhamma. But even more importantly than that, as a country, we have the most powerful form of protest. And we could do it every time we have an election. You know? So maybe we calm our minds a little bit and prepare for 2 years from now and 4 years from now. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't go out and protest, but we should do it with mindfulness. So when we protest, we should also have a solution. It's not enough to just say this sucks. We should say, this sucks, and let's try this. Excuse my language.
Just to kind of bring it back to the Eightfold Path, sort of practically using that to move through this time, you always talk about agitation and tension and things that cause agitation and tension. As human beings, we are sensitive to very subtle emotional tones in what other people are saying. So even the most, you know, centrist person who's reporting the news can say very subtle things that will trigger our egos.
Yep.
So I think, especially when you're getting your news, or when I'm getting my news, I try to be very mindful about how I'm getting it, how often I'm getting it, when I'm getting it, so where is my head when I'm getting it, so that because it is charged, I accept that it is charged, it's going to upset me, regardless of what it is. So am I in the space to be hearing that right now? Kent, am I ready for my daily, you know, intake? And am I prepared to accept that it's going to make me uncomfortable, whatever it is? That, I think, it goes back to accepting what's happening now. And also in applying that to being able to take everything not personally, is you're hearing things through other people's
egos.
Yep.
Yes.
So that's going to charge up my ego.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you're right or left, what's happening right now is the president is trying to literally just undo things. So that's more change that's going to cause tension and agitation, regardless of your attachments. It's just different.
Yep.
Which is going to be uncomfortable. So that kind of just big picture.
Yeah,
every day I try to have that conversation.
He feels emboldened, and rightly so, because of he's doing the things that he said he was going to do, and that and again, not to put him down, we're dealing with someone who has an extremely big ego.
Oh my god!
It's going to be agitating to people.
Right.
But we don't have to react to it, and when we do react, it's time to remember that that's not the best way to deal with something. To maintain as calm and a peaceful mind as we can.
In your words of whenever you feel like you absolutely have to do something, sit down and do nothing, has been really helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No matter what we're doing, if it's from a reactionary, fearful, angry point of view that motivates us, it's never going to be helpful. It just won't. We'll end up spitting on soldiers, you know? It just doesn't work. So, we need to maintain our mindfulness as best we can and understand that everything changes. This is an extreme example of the First Noble Truth. So there's also a great opportunity to develop the Four Noble Truths in this situation. Develop the Eightfold Path. Lorna, Ellie, it's a little after 10. You mentioned you had to...
Oh my gosh.
It's 3 after. I'm sorry. I was mindful to tell you before, but it's good to see you. I hope you found some benefit. Lorna, how are you?
There's no way I can follow that. well, I've had a difficult week. Personally, I've had a difficult week. And I realized I followed John's class on the Tuesday and this afternoon. And I realized that they were out of step for a while. I realized that's a lot of studying and a lot of mindfulness and a lot of reading and a lot of concentration. And I was trying to do it all, you know, because I want to be the best. My ego's right. I love this stuff, you know. So anyway, I sort of burned and crashed a bit. And I've come to realize that I was doing more studying and more reading and more thinking and contemplating it, but I wasn't actually doing the practice, you know, of just being mindful of the moment, being mindful of thoughts coming and going. So this week I've sort of not done my homework, deliberately not done my homework, but I've deliberately stepped into the path of what we should be doing anyway. And I feel a lot better about it.
Good.
A lot more relaxed in my mind, a lot happier. I had a great day yesterday. So I'm speaking to impermanence that I do observe that I have got it, that things are, everything in the world is impermanent. I stick a bit still on my own feelings and my own consciousness. I get wrapped up in the time at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so in the moment, I am regarding my own thoughts to myself. I don't always think of, it'll pass, it's impermanent. Da, da, da. So I kind of like stick in my own ego on my own thoughts until I get a dong on the head and you remind yourself that it's impermanent anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm working on that. Ego. I'm always conscious of that. Dukkha, wishing things were different than it is. Well, I catch myself doing that, and realize that's what I'm doing, wishing life was different than it is. So, hopefully in a mindful, forgiving way, just come back to this is life, and
mm-hmm.
it's not so bad, and accept it as it is. And so I just come, just all the basic practices. I've been thinking about some of the basic practices of what we should be practicing this week, more than the teachings out there and the concentration that requires, because I was just getting a bit bogged down with it and a bit overwhelmed by it. So I've just sort of stepped back from the teachings and the book and the reading, and that's just what I needed to do to be kind to myself mm-hmm. at this time, and that's just where I am this week.
Good for you.
Oh.
and you've had a direct experience of impermanence, and you recognize it, mm-hmm. Because you've developed a framework to see it. So, mm-hmm. thank you. Mary, it's good to see you. How are you this morning?
I started reading the chapter. I've read it before, and I always read through it and think, well, this makes so much sense. And then that's where it ends. Yeah, this makes up a lot of sense, but how do you apply these things? It's it's difficult, especially in these times. And what I try to do is not get too emotional about things and try to take steps that make sense mm-hmm. to, try to influence what's going on by, basically contacting my representatives in Washington
mm-hmm.
and then try to move on. I almost liken that chapter to being, if you're caught in a riptide, don't fight it.
Mm-hmm.
You go with it and it mm-hmm. stops, and then you can swim to shore. And that's kind of life.
Yeah.
But it's so hard not to fight it. It's very hard not to fight it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect metaphor for it, though, isn't it? You get caught in a riptide, you relax, and you get out of it. And that it's always the right response to not lose our minds. It's so hard not to when things happen that seem so contrary to what is acceptable. But everything changes. Everything changes. The Buddha counseled kings and other leaders during his time. And what he impressed on them was the need for fairness and to practice the Dhamma. He didn't say you need to annihilate everyone. He didn't go to extremes. And he also understood impermanence. You know, everything changes. He impressed on leaders that you may not always be the leader. You know, understand that. You know. Anyway, that's it. I'm glad you're here. It's 10 after 10, but I'd like to give the talk. I hope you can, and I'll make it brief, but I'll introduce dependent origination. And you'll study it this week, and we'll talk about it next week. I'm going to be... I said I'm going to be brief, but...
It's a good idea you had about feeling and talking to, you know, sending letters to representatives. It's almost like going back to the breathing and the meditation.
Correct.
I completely, that has not occurred.
Oh, no, you have to do that. Apparently, it does make a difference.
Yeah. Because these guys, a lot of them are looking to get reelected,
correct,
as you said, in 2
years.
That's
exactly
a great idea.
I've done research.
That, really.
Yeah. I mean, I've called Lance's office, I've spoken with his secretaries, I've written letters.
I've written him 2 letters.
Yeah. I mean, Cory Booker and Menendez are... Well, it doesn't hurt to remind them.
But still, you can remind them. Yeah. The thing is that they need to reach across the aisle.
Yeah.
They need to come together as a Congress.
Yeah.
And that's what I said to Lance. I said, you know, convince your colleagues in the Senate not to vote for this person, mm-hmm. you know. And the same thing with Cory Booker and Menendez, to just tell them they have to reach out. You know, they have to. They're so polarized. Okay, but anyway.
Okay, so.
And that does work.
Great speech.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the system that we have, and it works pretty well that way.
It works really well. Yeah.
Okay, so as briefly as I can, the dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to. He didn't teach it for much later in his teaching career. His first teaching was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, because that is the Four Noble Truths are the result of dependent origination. Dependent origination states that from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. The first noble truth is dukkha occurs. So this is how dukkha occurs. And I'll just go through the links rather quickly. The first link of dependent origination, just the name shows us that for suffering to arise, it's dependent on certain conditions. So, from ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. Fabrications, the best mental fabrications, the most simplest term to describe that is assumptions. We make assumptions over things. We all know what that assume when we break it up with that does. So that's assumptions. Those are mental fabrications. Rooted in ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths, we experience life, and because of ignorance, we start forming fabrications, assumptions, based on ignorance. Right? From that, from fabrications or from assumptions, as a requisite condition, required, as a requisite condition comes consciousness. So we're not talking about that grand cosmic consciousness with a big C that we're all part of, whether we are or not. We're talking about an ongoing thought process, consciousness, that is rooted in ignorance and is now informed by assumptions, mental fabrications. Fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness, comes this ongoing thinking that we're now involved in. Another way of saying that is conditioned thinking. From consciousness with a small c, from consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. Name and form in Pali is written nama rupa, which simply means, nama means name, rupa means form. It means that I have a physical form, and I give it a name. I have identified myself as this physical form. From consciousness as a requisite condition. Now remember, it's consciousness rooted in ignorance. From an ongoing thought process that is rooted in ignorance comes an identity as this is me. Do you see the connection to ignorance? This identity is rooted in ignorance. A component of ignorance, and what is necessary for ignorance to continue, is the ego personality, me. I need to ignore what's in front of me. In order to maintain ignorance, we must continue to ignore reality. Right? From name and form, as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. So it's an interesting progression here. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses and that sixth sense of consciousness. Remember, that consciousness is rooted in ignorance. So I've identified myself as me, this is me, and the way that human beings interact with the world is through their senses. That's what we do. So now I'm having a sensory experience, but my interpretation of that sensory experience is rooted in ignorance. What's going to follow from that? My interpretation is ignorant. I'm no longer able to use this sixth sense base in a wise and useful way. I'm only using it to continue my own ignorance. That's clinging, which comes up in another couple steps. From the sixth sense, I lost the page. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition. So this is a progression of required conditions. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes feeling. So someone asked after last Tuesday's class, how do you define feeling? Is feeling something that, you know, is that a feeling? Is it an emotion? A feeling in this sense is any movement in the mind. Anything that causes a reaction in the mind is a feeling in this sense. So don't be too narrow. This is a very broad interpretation of feeling. And remember the progression now. I'll repeat that. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. So something comes in my senses. I have a reaction that's rooted in ignorance. That's a feeling. It could be a feeling that I just found out that I won the lottery. I am the luckiest person in the world. Or I just found out that my guy didn't win the election. Now I'm miserable. Those are feelings. Rooted in ignorance. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. So something happens. Might as well keep using the explanation. There was a less than satisfying result in an election. My feeling now is I'm craving for that to be different. And because of the identity that I have, I'm clinging to that craving. And that can give rise to all types of agitated mind states, can it? This is being a pretty good, useful, the election's being pretty useful, isn't it? Yeah. So now, and as we've all experienced, it's hard to stop that craving, isn't it? And that craving and clinging to that need for things to be different can lead me to more, even more mindless actions if I lose it. So, from craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So now I've had that reaction in my mind. I've become agitated in my mind, and I want to blame someone for that too. Someone made me feel this way. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. That's the clinging and maintaining part. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. And this is pointing to the potential that each moment has. I've now become something rooted in craving and clinging. What have I become? And using the example, I've now become someone who is agitated. It could be anything. Forget about the extreme example I'm using, and it could be any type of person now. I've had a good experience. I just had my first bite of chocolate cake. I can't get enough of it. That's craving, and now I'm clinging to the identity of someone who needs chocolate cake to be happy, or someone who needs a different result in an election to be happy. My happiness is based on my views, on the sensory input that's coming, rather than, and all of those situations are impermanent, rather than recognizing the foolishness of these assumptions that I've made that are rooted in ignorance. Is everybody following me? From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. Notice how far down the path this is. And this is where dependent origination is often misinterpreted as a creation myth by the later developed schools. And you, obviously, there's nothing in here that talks about creation. And even in a physical birth, that's not what the Buddha is referring to. What he's referring to as giving birth is giving birth to a moment that is rooted in ignorance in that process. So now I've given birth to a self that is rooted in ignorance. From birth as a requisite condition, now, from that point on, because of giving birth to an ignorant me, from birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. When the Buddha first described dukkha, that's exactly how he said it. Dukkha is birth, dukkha is sickness, dukkha is aging, dukkha is death. And then he said, not getting what is wanted, what is desired is dukkha. Getting what is not desired is dukkha. And then he concluded that with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. We're going to talk about five clinging aggregates next week. But a simple explanation of five clinging aggregates is clinging to these ignorant views. In short, clinging to these views is suffering. Am I clear? And remember, those views are now rooted in ignorance. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I think we've gone far enough today. When you read this, now the Buddha gets into, in reverse order, how to undo this. And it's enough to know that once we recognize, through the Eightfold Path, any one of these causative links as rooted in ignorance and let go of the link, the whole chain of dependencies falls apart. That's how awakening occurs, by understanding this process. Now, this is not something that should be memorized or all that won't hurt, but to not be over analytical, what's most important is to simply recognize this ongoing process. And you could say that dependent origination, this process, occurs so quickly and continually that we can't recognize the process until we break it down into its components. Is that clear? You can almost say that dependent origination occurs outside of time until that aspect of giving birth to this moment. And again, don't get too caught up in even that, what I'm saying, but just recognize that it's an ongoing process that you can observe and that you can dismantle by developing the Four Noble Truths through the Eightfold Path. Obviously, you can see that it takes a well-concentrated mind to even see this, isn't it? But remember, this is what the Buddha awakened to, this profound understanding that it's ignorance of the true nature of the world, meaning Four Noble Truths, meaning that it's ignorance of understanding that dukkha is going to occur. Unsatisfactory, disappointing experiences are part of life. Having a human life is accepting that process. We can't change it, but we don't have to contribute to it by insisting that life be any different than what's occurring. So, excuse the long class and maybe too long of a talk, but that's it. So we'll discuss dependent origination this week, and then next week I'll introduce the five clinging aggregates. We're splitting this week 8 up into two weeks because there's a lot there. So any I know you got to go.
No, I got 5 minutes.
Okay, yeah, we'll finish with matter. But are there any questions about this and what we talked about this morning? Okay. Great, clear. We'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta, entirely appropriate for right now. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.